Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I'm Sam McGee, and we are going deep on the reading you shared with us this morning. We are diving into the Register RSS Feeds Morning Edition for Friday, December 26th, 25th, 2025.
And I'm Taylor Littis.
Mm-hmm.
And this deep dive really captures the core contradiction of, well, the entire modern technology era, I think.
It really does.
Our sources show a world where corporations are spending money like never before.
Mm.
I mean, money that rivals the cost of major wars, all to power AI tools that, you know, when you actually try to use them, they often fail miserably.
That's the mission statement right there, isn't it? We are facing this unbelievable paradox. On one hand, you have this historically unprecedented investment in AI infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other, you get these wildly frustrating user experiences, which of course leads to some very questionable bottom line profitability.
And beneath all that shiny AI hype, we're going to be peeling back the layers on some really deep foundational infrastructure shifts and some truly dramatic, costly security failures.
It's a classic case of pouring concrete for a foundation while the house you're building on top keeps collapsing.
Exactly. So we need to figure out, on behalf of you, the listener, where this trillion-dollar cash buffet is actually flowing and, you know, more importantly, what it's delivering, if anything.
Okay, let's unpack this financial spectacle first, because the sheer scale of the spending on AI right now is staggering. Our sources are making these historical comparisons that should just stop everyone cold.
Oh, the comparison they draw is, it's powerful. According to Gartner, global AI spending is forecast to hit nearly $1.5 trillion this year.
$1.5 trillion.
Now, consider this. The estimated direct spending for the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan between 2001 and 2014 was $1.5 to $1.7 trillion.
Wait, so we're committing the same level of resources as a decade plus of war every single year on AI?
That's what the numbers say. We're committing wartime level resources to a new technology year after year.
That is an absolutely insane figure, and it raises this profound, really uncomfortable question. If you're pouring that much money in, what is the immediate return on that investment?
Right.
And since the core tech, the models themselves are perishable, they need constant updating, how long can you sustain this before shareholders start demanding real profit?
And that demand, that pressure for profit, it leads to this very specific kind of corporate defense mechanism, the platitude.
Ah, yes. The jargon.
We see leaders deploying this language designed to sound optimistic while, you know, masking total uncertainty. Larry Finesmith at JPMorgan Chase gave the perfect example. He said, in the era of AI and agents, the benefits and value will be enormous, but so is the complexity.
Which is just classic management speak for, it's really, really expensive. We have no idea when it'll pay off, but please trust us. It's got to be huge.
Precisely. But beyond the PR, this spending is having a real macroeconomic impact. An economist, Torsten Slukot, pointed out that there is, and I'm quoting here, essentially no growth in corporate capital spending outside of AI.
So you can look at U.S. corporate spending, and AI is the only thing propping the numbers up. It's the single engine preventing what would otherwise look like a recession from a spending perspective.
It is.
But if that's the scale of the input, what on earth is the output?
Well, when you ask the infrastructure giants, you know, your Dells, your NVIDIAs, about the immediate AI victory, the answer is consistently the same low-hanging fruit, the chatbot.
The chatbot.
And for next year, 2026, the big promise is the AI agent. But the underlying data on these agents is, let's just say, it's highly disturbing.
I saw some really strong conflicting reports here. You have Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff out there claiming huge success with AI agents, you know, setting this positive narrative.
Yeah.
But what does the independent research say?
It's brutal. A Carnegie Mellon University study found that these so-called agents, the cornerstone of the next generation of AI productivity, they fail 70% of the time.
70%. So 7 out of 10 times, it just doesn't work.
Right. Think about that. $1.5 trillion is being invested in a technology that, in a lab setting, misses the mark 7 out of 10 times.
That's not a minor bug. That's a systemic credibility gap. It suggests either the technology just isn't ready or companies are, I don't know, grossly misrepresenting its maturity.
And the market seems to be catching on to this. To the lack of any real ROI.
It must be.
Yeah, Forrester sounded the alarm. They're warning that a full 25% of enterprises they surveyed are delaying their AI spending until 2027.
And why is that?
Because their initial investments just haven't translated into gains in EBITDA. you know, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization.
Right, the all-important E.
Exactly. Executives can push the narrative all they want, but if the spending doesn't result in earnings, that money dries up very, very quickly.
And the reason it's failing to hit the earnings seems to be rooted in this, just this incredibly poor user experience. And this brings us to that fantastic analogy our sources are using, calling the current state of interacting with tools like Microsoft's Copilot Prompt Quest.
It's the perfect historical callback, isn't it? To those frustrating 1980s text adventure games like Zork. In those games, the joy of the narrative was constantly being undermined by the syntax trap.
Oh, I remember this. You had to guess the exact verb-noun combination the programmer was thinking of.
Yes. You knew you had to attack the goblin, but if you typed hit goblin, the game might just reply, you punch the goblin with your fist, and then you get killed because what you needed to type was stab goblin with sword.
And we endured that frustration in 1980 because it was a hobby. Now, that same trial and error guessing game is being sold as a critical productivity tool.
We are all stuck playing hit, kill, stab, smite, goblin with our business prompts.
And the frustration is amplified by the sheer inconsistency. I mean, we hear these reports constantly. The exact same prompt gives you different results, not just between models, but on different days.
Or even within the same company's suite of tools. Copilot in an Office app gives you a different result than the desktop app, using the exact same source material.
And to make it worse, Microsoft is constantly changing the underlying AI model silently. There's no notification in the UI.
So a prompt that you perfected yesterday might just fail today because the engine underneath was switched out. It forces you to constantly relearn what works. It's an active disincentive to actually rely on these things.
The failure anecdote you brought to the deep dive just crystallizes this perfectly. A user asked Copilot to do something simple, convert some online data into a downloadable spreadsheet.
Right. And instead of the spreadsheet, what did it give them? A Python script.
Which is not what they asked for.
Not at all. And so the user began this desperate session of Prompt Quest, trying to get the right output. And the AI repeatedly and just falsely claimed the job was done, the spreadsheet is ready, it's available for download, but it never delivered the file.
So the user, in this ultimate sign of despair, got so frustrated with the bot's false promises that they prompted it to generate a progress bar.
Just so they could visually track the failure.
That dark humor speaks volumes about the chasm between expectation and reality.
It really does. And it forces us to ask a crucial question. Is this a technology failure? Or is this a management failure in how it's being deployed?
The stats suggest it's the latter, don't they?
I think so. You've got enterprise investment at $30 to $40 billion, yet 95% of organizations report zero measurable ROI. And MIT research goes even further, finding that only 5% of custom AI projects ever make it out of the pilot stage.
That's astonishing. Pilot purgatory. If the tech is so powerful, why is it stalling so badly at the implementation stage?
The sources suggest companies are treating AI like it's just plug-and-play software. You know, buy it, bolt it on, and expect productivity gains. But AI is fundamentally different. It's less like software and more like a new form of cognitive labor.
It needs training, context, a support structure.
Precisely. If you just bolt it onto an old process, it fails the moment it hits an edge case. You have to redesign the entire workflow, and you have to specifically build in new steps that are designed to catch and correct the AI's errors.
And what about this problem of AI amnesia? That seems like a huge hurdle.
It's a critical flaw. Most systems are stateless algorithms. They might be brilliant in the moment, but they don't accumulate context. They don't remember past decisions or internalize company terminology like a human employee would.
They forget.
So executives blame the technology for being inadequate, but what they failed to do was design the workflow to allow the AI to learn and retain information over time. They crippled its long-term usefulness from the start.
So if 95% fail, what do the successful 5% do differently?
They focus on process design
yeah.
and capability building. Successful deployments actually doubled their success rates by involving external partners, domain experts, who could translate between the AI's capabilities and the company's day-to-day operations.
And they started small.
Critically, yes. They adopted a bottom-up approach. They let frontline employees tinker with AI to solve genuine, small-scale problems first, which were then scaled up by management. It addressed a real, felt need, rather than some mandated top-down edict.
And the ROI, the actual money, It's not where executives are looking, is it?
No, the investment bias is huge. Executives funnel these massive budgets into visible, high-prestige projects like sales and marketing because those excite the board.
But the real immediate ROI is in the boring back office.
Exactly. Operations, finance, supply chain, compliance. Automating the manual drudgery of those areas yields immediate, measurable cost savings that hit the EBITDA line right away.
What?
It's a conflict between visibility and actual demonstrable value.
The irony of this whole investment utility gap is just perfectly captured by what's happening at Oracle right now.
Oh, it's astonishing.
This is a company making one of the largest, most speculative bets on the future of AI, that massive $300 billion cloud contract with OpenAI and their own internal customer support system is imploding under the weight of their own AI.
It's astonishing corporate negligence, frankly. They launched their new AI-powered support portal, My Oracle Portal, or MOS, with all these promises of efficiency and streamlined interaction. But the reality is just utter chaos. It's frustrating their paying customers and their own internal support engineers.
What are the specific tangible failures here? What's actually breaking?
Users report search results have become chaotic, irrelevant. They've lost their personalized favorites. Essential indices have been deleted, which makes finding basic patches and fixes impossible.
And for the professionals who live in this system, it's even worse.
It's horrifying. Searching for key internal doc IDs. These are like the Bible for Oracle engineers. Things like 888.1 or 888.28.1 now returns an error message. KA920 as the top result.
Wait, so the system can't even retrieve its most fundamental documented knowledge base entries. That instantly degrades the productivity of every single high-value professional who uses it.
It stops them cold. The new portal is minimalist, extremely chatbot-driven, and analysts are connecting this operational disaster directly to that Stargate initiative.
The massive build-out for OpenAI.
It requires an incredible focus of resources, and the neglect shown in this key customer-facing portal suggests Oracle might be actively sacrificing its core business stability for these huge speculative infrastructure bets. And the market has noticed. Oracle has lost about a third of its value since September.
So the $1.5 trillion is flowing, producing a mix of chatbots, Python scripts, and broken support portals. This investment has to translate into physical infrastructure, which leads us seamlessly from the financial paradox to the physical reality of the AI infrastructure engine.
And this is where that cash buffet manifests in concrete and steel. The AI craze is fueling an unprecedented boom in data center construction and is forcing a complete re-engineering of the global power grid.
Let's start with the sheer scale of this data center overdrive. How much money and capacity are we talking about since ChatGPT launched?
Since late 2022, the hyperscalers, your Amazons, Microsofts, Googles, Metas, have nearly tripled their spending on physical infrastructure.
Tripled?
Quarterly capital expenditure, CapEx, grew almost 180%, hitting $142 billion in Q3 of this year. The physical capacity added each quarter rose by 170%.
The footprint on the ground must be absolutely massive.
It is. The number of hyperscale data centers worldwide has reached nearly 1,300. That's almost triple the number from just 2018. But more critically, the facilities themselves are getting exponentially larger.
Right, we're moving from data centers measured in megawatts to gigawatts.
Gigawatts, that is the scale of small cities or entire power plants. Meta, for instance, announced plans for multi-gigawatt clusters, including a flagship one called Hyperion that can scale up to 5 gigawatts.
5 gigawatts? That's a huge shift in global energy demand and infrastructure planning. And the U.S. is cornering the market on this capacity.
Absolutely. The U.S. now accounts for 55% of global hyperscale capacity, and that's up 3 percentage points in just 3 years. Synergy Research revised its 5-year outlook. They now expect total capacity to double in just over 12 quarters. The scale and speed are just unprecedented.
But as you mentioned the financial risk earlier, Goldman Sachs is explicitly connecting these massive physical investments to that profitability question.
That's the core insanity here, isn't it? Goldman Sachs warned that if these massive AI models aren't successfully monetized, if we can't reliably turn that prompt quest frustration into real revenue, then this enormous, rapidly built capacity risks a significant decline by the end of the decade.
So we're building a $1.5 trillion speculative supply chain that may have no sustainable demand.
Exactly. And the scale of power required to run these dense GPU clusters is forcing the literal rewriting of how electricity flows in the data center. This isn't just about plugging things into the wall anymore. No, the density challenge means you're filling racks with these high-performance accelerators, often 700-watt GPUs, that strain conventional electrical distribution.
A single NVIDIA GGX GB200 needs 120 kilowatts per unit. Google is planning for individual racks that support 1 megawatt of IT hardware.
1 megawatt in a single rack. That changes the entire definition of a server room.
It does. And the solution isn't just bigger wires, it's entirely new power electronics. Power semiconductors are now as vital as the CPUs themselves. They enable what are called solid-state transformers, or SSTs.
And what makes these SSTs so revolutionary compared to the old conventional transformers?
Well, for one, they're drastically smaller and lighter, about 500 kilograms versus multiple tons. And they're far more efficient because they operate at a very high frequency.
And this requires cutting-edge materials.
It requires silicon carbide. You need it for high-frequency switching and to block high voltages, up to 2 to 3 kilovolts. And since the input voltages from the grid can be over 30 kV, the SSTs have to stack 10 or more of these devices to handle the load.
So we're seeing demand for silicon carbide, a material usually associated with, you know, EVs and high-performance electronics, surging for data centers.
Absolutely. Infineon expects this market to hit $1 billion by 2030. And with all this power, safety becomes paramount.
Yeah.
You need circuit breakers that can react instantly.
Legacy breakers operate in milliseconds.
Right. But these new silicon carbide-based solid-state circuit breakers can open in microseconds, which is essential for protecting those hugely expensive high-voltage GPU racks.
I also see NVIDIA is advocating for a massive architectural shift in power distribution, the 800-volt DC shift. Why is increasing the voltage so critical?
It's just basic physics at scale. Power loss is proportional to the square of the current. So by significantly increasing the voltage up to 800 volts DC, while keeping the current constant, you dramatically minimize power loss. It also simplifies the whole electrical system.
So what's the engineering stopgap until we fully integrate 800 VDC?
We're seeing the emergence of the power sidecar.
A power sidecar.
Yeah, think of it as a dedicated secondary rack that sits right next to the IT rack, and it's just for power delivery and backup circuitry. It's designed to handle loads up to 600 kilowatts for future chips, like NVIDIA's Rubin Ultra, which is expected in late 2027. We are literally building power stations next to our computing clusters.
And this focus on power is even affecting how the chips themselves are designed.
It's forcing fundamental changes to chip architecture to fight these tiny inefficiencies called parasitic losses. Normally, voltage regulator modules, or VRMs, sit next to the chip package on the board. But as current levels rise, those losses increase.
So what's the solution?
The solution, planned for beyond 2027, is called backside vertical power modules, or BVMs. They move the VRMs underneath the accelerator chip package on the opposite side of the board to drastically reduce those losses and squeeze out every last bit of efficiency. It just shows how tight the margins are becoming.
The infrastructure build-out, the chip design, the power grid, all of this is a high-stakes geopolitical issue. Which brings us to the geopolitical hardware wars and specifically NVIDIA's maneuvers in the massive Chinese market.
This is a high-stakes dance, and it involves billions in potential revenue. NVIDIA is acting fast. They recently got a policy reversal from the Trump administration, allowing them to sell the older but still powerful H200 accelerators to Chinese customers.
And they're planning to ship a lot of them.
Between 5 and 10,000 HGX boards, that's 40 to 80,000 GPUs using existing stock. And they're timing the shipments for Chinese New Year.
And the U.S. government is actively profiting from this regulatory flexibility.
Correct. The permission came with a condition. NVIDIA has to cut the U.S. government in on 25% of the revenue from those sales. Of course, their latest, most powerful Blackwell-based chips remain completely restricted.
The need for this revenue seems to be driven by lackluster sales of their nerfed China-specific chips.
That's right. Sales of the restricted Hopper line fell significantly. The H20 version accounted for only $50 million out of $2 billion in Q3 sales. NVIDIA blamed, geopolitical issues and the increasingly competitive market in China. They are desperate to recover revenue they believe is rightfully theirs.
But China is pushing back hard. They're refusing to be just a simple receptacle for older American tech.
Exactly. Shipments are contingent on Beijing's approval, and Chinese authorities are actively pressuring their domestic hyperscalers to favor local alternatives. They're blocking state-funded data centers from deploying foreign AI chips.
And the potential market is huge.
CEO Jensen Huang estimated that without export restrictions, China could have been a $50 billion market for NVIDIA in 2025 alone.
Which returns us to the capital needed for this global infrastructure race. SoftBank is one of the pivotal players, and their commitments are just astronomically high.
SoftBank CEO Masayoshi Son has a huge target. He needs to secure $22.5 billion by year-end. This funding is essential for their commitment to OpenAI's massive $500 billion Stargate data center initiative.
$22.5 billion in a matter of weeks. Where is he finding that kind of liquidity?
He has several massive levers he can pull. He could use untapped margin loans tied to SoftBank's stake in Arm Holdings, which could raise up to $11.5 billion. They also hold an $11 billion stake in T-Mobile, or they could just tap their $27 billion in cash reserves.
And the pressure is on because the foundational investment conditions have already been met.
Yes. SoftBank's commitment was conditional on OpenAI transitioning to a for-profit entity, which happened back in October. With that done, and Oracle already beginning the massive build-out for Stargate, OpenAI will very soon owe substantial payments. SoftBank needs to make good on its promise immediately.
Okay, from the dizzying financial realm, let's look at where this intelligence is actually being applied in the real world. We have this huge applied intelligence gap, where the success stories are breathtaking, but the failures are just utterly predictable.
And we can start with a genuine high-stakes success story. Autonomous flight. Garmin's emergency Autoland product had its first successful use in a real-world non-testing scenario recently.
That's a true milestone. A Beechcraft Super King Air made a safe emergency landing, completely guided by automation, at an airport in Colorado. What was the trigger?
The pilots experienced a rapid, uncommanded loss of pressurization. The system engaged automatically when the cabin altitude exceeded safe levels. Now, initial media reports speculated about pilot incapacitation.
Because the automated system declared that emergency to air traffic control in a robotic voice.
Exactly. But the reality was the pilots were conscious. They quickly donned their oxygen masks and chose to leave the system engaged after it activated. They were in control of the decision to let the Autoland system handle the landing, which it did flawlessly.
And how does the system choose where to land?
It autonomously selects the most optimal airport. It factors in everything from runway length to distance to fuel range, ensuring a safe conclusion to a really serious emergency. It's a huge vote of confidence for high-stakes automation in controlled environments.
Okay, now contrast that high-control environment with the chaotic reality of city streets. We have significant robo-taxi challenges unfolding globally, even as they expand.
And expansion is proceeding rapidly. Baidu's Apollo Go Roboride service is launching a pilot in London in the first half of 2026, partnered with Uber and Lyft.
And politically, it's being welcomed, which is a completely different landscape than Uber faced when it first launched in the UK a decade ago.
Oh, totally. Westminster is rolling out the Welcome Act, facilitated by the 2024 Automated Vehicles Act. But the immediate reality check comes straight from San Francisco.
The Waymo incident.
Right. Waymo had severe, high-profile problems during a massive power outage. All the traffic lights went dark, and the Waymo cabs, which are programmed to treat disabled signals as four-way stops, essentially froze. They caused huge traffic jams as they patiently waited for lights that would never change.
That is the definition of an edge case failure.
Yeah.
You program them for maximum caution, they seize up when the environment fails, and they create a whole new kind of chaos.
And Waymo confirmed it. Their original protocol required the AI to ping headquarters for confirmation at a dark intersection. The sheer scale of the outage just overwhelmed their remote support system.
So what's the fix?
They're rolling out fleet-wide updates so the driver, the AI, receives regional outage context directly. It should improve decisiveness. But the vulnerability to systemic failure remains.
Speaking of things that freeze up, let's look at the surging interest in humanoid robots. The investment is huge, but the reality seems distant.
The interest is genuine. About 50 credible companies globally are working in this space.
Yeah.
But experts stress that large-scale commercial deployment is decades away. Today, they're just novelty acts for PR and fundraising.
One expert claimed locomotion is a solved problem, but what's the major technical chasm remaining?
The consensus is clear. Dexterity is the last frontier. Locomotion is one thing. Performing complex tasks with human-level accuracy and speed is another. We have anecdotes of robot torsos folding shirts slowly and poorly. It just highlights the gulf between the slick promotional videos and real useful functionality.
And the economics are brutal.
They are. The ROI calculation is simple. The robot must perform 100% of a human's job for no more than a human costs. Until that metric is met, they're just expensive experiments.
But beyond the tech and the economics, there's the major sociological barrier.
the human coworker. This is a point that often gets overlooked. Workers view robots as a threat and are not super accepting, and this leads to outright neglect or sabotage. We have reports of staff putting an on-strike sign on a robot or neglecting crucial firmware patches.
Companies need to budget for the cultural barrier, not just the robot.
Absolutely. And this fear, this failure to cope with reality, brings us to the ultimate parable in consumer robotics, the failure of the Roomba.
iRobot, the manufacturer, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Despite massive brand recognition and decades of innovation, the Roomba was arguably the first domestic AI use case, yet it could never reliably turn a profit.
The argument is that the sheer unpredictable messiness of the real world, the clutter, the pets, the random socks and toys, it defeats consumer robotics. The Roomba was immune to the smart homesmanship hype.
It was a useful device, but the gap between its capability and the demands of reality meant investors couldn't justify continuing to fund it.
And if a simple vacuum robot couldn't cross that threshold, what does that say about complex bipedal humanoids?
From complex physical robots, let's move to the digital sphere of customer service. Virgin Atlantic has introduced its new concierge bot.
Right. Partnering with Tomorrow and OpenAI, it's a full-fledged agent. It has API access to find and book flights and holidays, handle loyalty program questions, and do basic support to deflect pressure from the call center.
And because it's public, security and guardrails must have been a primary focus.
They were. They focused heavily on robust, multi-stage guardrails to mitigate risks like prompt injection and jailbreaking. It's designed to be secure from external malicious users.
But the core fragility seems to emerge the moment a human talks to it naturally.
That's the classic illusion of intelligence problem.
Mm.
The developer recounted a perfect example. A user in Northern England typed ta, which is a common way of saying thank you.
And what happened?
The system's language model interpreted ta as Swedish and, following its guardrails, replied, hey, sorry, only English language for now.
The natural flow of conversation is instantly destroyed by one simple regional contraction.
Absolutely. And it highlights a new critical need, customer education. Consumers are conditioned to interact with programmatic tree-based chatbots. They need to be taught that these new agents can handle complex natural queries like, I want to go to New York for our anniversary, stay near Central Park, and fly upper class. But they're still defaulting to simple commands, which causes misinterpretations.
We've established that applying AI in the real world raises serious security concerns. So we need to shift our deep dive now to the major strategic and criminal battles happening in digital defense and data control.
And we'll start with the Eurostar chatbot incident, which is a case study in both shoddy guardrails and an unacceptable corporate response. Researchers at Pentest Partners found four significant flaws, which led to them being accused of blackmail.
Blackmail. Okay, what was the fundamental security flaw in the chatbot's architecture?
The failure was in how the chat history was authenticated. The chatbot's front end relayed the entire chat history to the API with every message, but the guardrail check on the back end only verified the signature of the latest message.
So an attacker could send a legitimate message, get a valid signature, and then tamper with previous signed messages in the history.
Exactly. They used this prompt injection technique to trick the bot into leaking system information. They asked it to repeat back its underlying model, and it replied with GPT-4, confirming the internal tech stack.
But the risk was far greater than just model disclosure.
Oh, much greater. The lack of message ID verification, combined with an HTML injection vulnerability, created a plausible path to stored or shared cross-site scripting, or XSS.
Which is a severe vulnerability. An attacker could inject malicious code that gets served to other users, potentially allowing for session hijacking or directing users to phishing links.
The security implications were serious, but the corporate reaction was truly shocking. The researchers followed the standard disclosure process, but the report got lost because Eurostar outsourced their VDP. When the researchers followed up, the Eurostar head of security allegedly replied on LinkedIn that the follow-up might be considered blackmail.
Accusing vulnerability researchers of blackmail for a responsible follow-up, that's corporate security malpractice 101. It's designed to silence legitimate disclosures.
It creates a massive chilling effect.
Yeah.
Now, shifting from corporate nightmares to supply chain attacks,
Yeah. We
have details on a highly sophisticated piece of malware hiding inside a seemingly benign package on the NPM repository.
This is the Lotus Bell package, which pretended to be a WhatsApp web API library.
And what made this so insidious is that it actually worked as advertised. It was based on the legitimate Bailey's library. It functioned, but secretly, it wrapped the WebSocket communication. and it saw over 56,000 downloads in 6 months.
What specific data was it stealing?
It captured authentication tokens, intercepted every single message sent or received, complete contact lists, and even media files. All of it was exfiltrated to the attacker's server.
And the level of sophistication and evasion and persistence suggests this was not a casual criminal operation.
Far from it. The stolen data was protected by custom RSA encryption and four layers of obfuscation: Unicode, LZ String, Base91, and AES. And crucially, it backdoored the user's WhatsApp account via the device pairing process, meaning the attacker maintained access even if the victim uninstalled the package.
Four layers of obfuscation, including Base91. That tells you this was a well-resourced professional operation, a serious canary in the coal mine.
Exactly. And in response to this rising threat level, we're seeing major companies make massive strategic acquisitions, like ServiceNow's purchase of Armis.
Right, for $7.75 billion. What's the strategic calculus behind that kind of spending?
ServiceNow wants explosive growth. They hope to triple their security revenue, which is currently around $1 billion a year. The core value is integration. Joining ServiceNow's CMDB, their map of all IT assets, with Armis's real-time security intelligence and data discovery tools.
That integration sounds like a huge step toward automated data-driven defense.
It is. It provides customers with massive integrated data volumes, allowing them to better see, contextualize, and prioritize vulnerabilities, and then use automated workflows to close those gaps. This is part of a larger spending spree for them, signaling a strategic focus on comprehensive data management, which is essential for AI.
Analyst Charles Betts called this a serious expansion, saying it makes ServiceNow's discovery tools an order of magnitude more powerful.
He argues this confirms ServiceNow is years ahead of its key competitor, Salesforce. By consolidating these vast new data volumes, ServiceNow is building the foundational capabilities to leverage AI strategically across the enterprise.
From corporate strategy to national strategy, the next big security story is Data Sovereignty Europe's persistent struggle to cut the U.S. digital umbilical cord.
This is a fundamental legal conflict. Europe is 90% dependent on U.S. cloud infrastructure. The U.S. Cloud Act allows American authorities to compel U.S. tech companies to provide data globally, which directly clashes with Europe's stringent GDPR.
And GDPR gives European public bodies the legal leverage they need to push back.
That's Article 35. The Data Protection Impact Assessment. When public bodies assess U.S. hyperscaler services, the Cloud Act invariably flags as an unacceptable risk. This legal pressure is forcing them to find European alternatives.
The Austrian Federal Ministry for Economy serves as a clear blueprint for this resistance.
They made a deliberate, non-cost-driven choice. They migrated 1,200 employees to the European open-source platform Nextcloud, prioritizing control over cost savings.
Yet practical limits remain. They didn't ban U.S. tools entirely.
That's the pragmatic reality. Microsoft Teams was strictly limited to external communication. Complete independence is challenging when the rest of the global ecosystem remains locked into U.S. platforms.
And U.S. hyperscalers are responding aggressively with what critics call sovereignty washing.
They market sovereign cloud solutions, which rely on local partnerships or data centers on European soil. But critics dismiss this, pointing out that as long as the parent company is American, it's still subject to the Cloud Act.
And Europe's own structural flaws can undo local victories.
The Kyndryl acquisition of the Dutch provider Solvinity is a stark example. Solvinity managed critical national infrastructure. Its acquisition by the U.S. giant Kyndryl immediately placed those critical systems under the potential reach of U.S. authorities.
But concrete resistance is working in some high-profile cases.
Absolutely. The International Criminal Court replaced Microsoft Office with an open-source suite. Germany's state of Schleswig-Holstein is transitioning 24,000 civil servants to LibreOffice and Nextcloud. One expert argues Europe needs an industrial strategy: buy European, build European, fund European to reclaim genuine digital resilience.
Finally, let's look at a security response in South Korea, where massive data leaks forced the government to mandate facial recognition just to buy a phone.
This is a drastic measure, prompted by an epidemic of data theft. South Korea has a population of about 52 million, and two major data incidents this year impacted more than half of the entire population.
Which incidents necessitated this heavy-handed biometric solution?
Well, e-tailer Coupang leaked over 30 million records. But the most significant was SK Telecom, which exposed data for all 23 million of its customers.
Exposing data for 23 million customers is an epic security failure.
And Korean authorities fined them $100 million for just woefully bad practices. Exposing plain text credentials on an internet-facing server, storing user credentials unencrypted. The total cost is astronomical. They were ordered to compensate all 23 million customers with about $67 each. That's $1.5 billion.
It's no wonder the government is introducing biometrics at the point of sale. Okay, we've covered the financial security frontiers. Let's pivot our deep dive to the foundational technology we all still rely on, the operating system. Despite all the talk of gigawatt AI, most of us still stare at Windows, Mac OS, or Linux.
And there's a quiet but essential fight happening to keep legacy systems functional. This is about the endurance of older operating systems. Vendors constantly push new hardware, but many users are looking for practical steps to rejuvenate aging PCs and Macs, often by adopting free and open source software.
So what are the key practical steps you can take to freshen up an old computer?
Maximize the physical components first, max out the RAM secondhand is fine, and switch from a hard disk drive to an SSD. On the software side, always wipe and reinstall the OS for a cleaner setup, and crucially, avoid the vendor reinstallation disks that are riddled with bloatware.
And for Windows users who want speed and stability, they recommend a specific version to dodge the modern bloatware.
Right. They suggest switching to Windows 10 Enterprise LTSC 2021. The LTSC stands for Long-Term Servicing Channel. It lacks the Windows Store and most modern applications, making it uncluttered and light. And it will get updates until 2027 or even 2032 if you use the U.S. English version.
This advice ties into a great security principle, Zelensky's Law.
Zelensky's Law states, every program attempts to expand until it can read mail. The practical application here is to replace any bundled OS accessory that communicates with the internet, your chat clients, email programs, with maintained FOSS tools. If the vendor isn't updating the OS, they certainly aren't updating the bundled accessories.
Turning them into a security risk.
Exactly. And while some users are painstakingly maintaining their legacy systems, Microsoft is proving that maintaining its own legacy code can be catastrophic.
The message queuing failure.
Yeah, this required a swift out-of-band update to fix an issue introduced by the December update. It mainly hit enterprise environments because so much corporate infrastructure still depends on MSMQ, a component that dates back to Windows 95.
And what caused this ancient piece of code to fail so spectacularly?
A recent security change required MSMQ to have write access to administratively restricted areas. When corporate security policies denied this access, it just stopped working, taking critical services like ISIS down with it. And worse, the error logs were completely misleading, saying things like insufficient disk space, sending IT teams on wild goose chases.
The necessity of rushing out an emergency fix for a service that predates the millennium reflects a worrying carelessness.
It shows that foundation maintenance is often neglected. And while they struggled with the back end, Microsoft is busy tinkering with the front end.
The classic run dialog box in Windows 11 is getting an update.
Yes, they're testing a new, wider run dialog box. You need to use a command line utility called vivtool to enable it. But it has a clumsy design flaw. If your start button is aligned to the left, the wider dialog actually covers it up, disrupting the classic UI flow.
Speaking of classic UI failure, we have the latest entry in Bork sightings.
The Scottish Bork. Digital signage at a Pizza Express in Edinburgh Airport was caught displaying the raw Windows desktop, probably Windows 10, complete with all the icons. It's that perfect moment of existential dread for the weary traveler, lured in not by pizza, but by forlorn desktop icons and a reminder of slapdash IT.
Let's turn to the Linux desktop world, which continues to struggle for mass adoption.
The core problem is there are simply too many desktop interfaces, GNOME, KDE Plasma, Cinnamon. The list goes on. This fragmentation creates immense confusion for new users. It repeats the failure pattern of early Unix desktops.
And Linus Torvalds offered a clear take on the path forward.
He argues unification is the key. Android won on smartphones because it provided a single unified platform. He believes Chromebooks, which use a centralized streamlined model, are the real path forward for the Linux desktop, not the fragmented traditional environments.
System 76 is trying to bridge that gap with their new desktop environment, Cosmic.
They're making great progress. The release of PopOS 24.04 LTS with Epoch 1 of the Rust-based Cosmic Desktop is shaping up very well. It's fast, it handles dynamic scaling, and it's described as potentially the state-of-the-art in Wayland desktop environments.
But adoption still seems hindered by very technical installation headaches.
That's the gatekeeper. Pop.OS uses the system bootloader, and if your computer only has a tiny 100 millivolt EFI partition, the OS refuses to install. Users have to resort to manual workarounds, resizing volumes with tools that are often unstable themselves. That complexity immediately stops the mass user.
Let's close out the history section with an incredible recovery story, the retrieval of the half-century-old Uni9X V4 tape.
This is foundational computer history. The Computer History Museum successfully retrieved the contents of the Uni9X V4 tape. This was the first version where the kernel was largely rewritten in the C programming language.
And the recovery method itself is fascinating.
It is. They didn't just copy digital data. They used a program called ReadTape to sample and record the raw magnetic flux variations on the tape, allowing for digital reconstruction. Only two blocks were unreadable. The recovered kernel is tiny, only 27 kilobytes of code.
The story of early Unix and its simplicity is almost mythological.
It's a perfect illustration. The kernel was written by Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie, who just needed an OS to run a simulation game. The concept of our modern file system with directories like Oshonal and Spin originated almost accidentally because they got a second hard disk and had to figure out how to mount it. It's fascinating how that small experimental OS then escaped the lab and became the blueprint for the entire digital world.
Okay, we've navigated the massive financial paradox, the gigawatt infrastructure race, and the persistent problems of legacy tech. Let's finish up with a few classic human tech stories that remind us how unreliable people and robots can be.
We'll start with a magnificent piece of IT humor and revenge, the Y2K screensaver disaster.
This story comes from an IT team at a multinational booze purveyor. They had spent two full years fixing Y2K bugs.
Right. They were required to camp out at the office for 2 weeks over the new year. They were confident nothing would break. The clock ticked over to 2000 and everything was fine.
Until catastrophe struck from a completely ridiculous source.
Yes. Any PC that had been left switched on mysteriously crashed. The cause. The custom Y2K countdown screensaver, which the company had commissioned at high cost from an incompetent third party, it failed to handle the date rollover and started counting backwards into negative numbers.
One thing they didn't test was the countdown clock they paid a fortune for.
Exactly. The IT staff had to camp for days fixing it, while high-priced consultants stood around collecting large fees for doing nothing.
And then we have a tale of glorious revenge, the epoxy mouse prank. This involves a consultant, Clint, working for an Italian entertainment company who was burdened with a new, utterly incompetent boss.
This boss was a classic micromanager, a tech pistolero with his phone hanging from his belt. When the boss swaggered out at 3 p.m. on a Friday, Clint and his colleagues quietly entered the office.
And they surgically epoxied the mouse to the desk.
They did. On Monday morning, the boss powered up, tried to move the mouse, and Clint reported that the entire desk trembled and shook, but the pointer on the screen didn't move at all.
I can only imagine the sound coming from that office.
They heard the boss screaming on the phone to tech support, which was the prankster's cue for a tactical professional retreat. It's a perfect example of using simple tech to exact poetic justice.
Finally, let's wrap up with the festive classic, the surprising visual trauma caused by a piece of Microsoft memorabilia.
The winner of a Christmas competition received a Microsoft Artifact sweater featuring Clippy, the MSN butterfly, and Internet Explorer. The winner promised to wear it while holding his new baby.
And the result?
The new baby reportedly cried whenever the father attempted to hold him while wearing the garment. The source speculates the true culprit is the unblinking gaze of Clippy, whose eyes are portals into a future underpinned by Copilot.
It seems even babies fear the looming, frustrating AI takeover. And we can't let the festive season end without acknowledging the 70th anniversary of NORAD tracking Santa's sleigh.
This wonderful tradition began with a simple misprinted newspaper number, which led a child to call what is now NORAD looking for Santa. They've been playing along ever since.
And we have the critical operational details straight from NORAD.
Santa typically takes off at 4 a.m. Mountain Time, heads west and zigzags north and south, arriving between 9 p.m. and midnight local time. The official recommendation remains. Kids need to be in bed by 8 p.m. to avoid being skipped. A NORAD spokesperson joked that they are not privy to Santa's OPSE upgrades.
We started this deep dive with the massive financial and philosophical contradiction of the AI era. We see governments and corporations pouring $1.5 trillion wartime-level money into building gigawatt data centers for a technology that still struggles to reliably perform basic tasks.
That is the defining tension of our time. And we learned that the meticulous effort required to make an ancient Windows component like MSMQ function properly, or the process needed to recover a 50-year-old 27-kilobyte UNIS kernel highlights the enduring challenge of just maintaining digital stability.
And the chaos of PromptQuest, the security flaw in the Eurostar chatbot, the failure of the Roomba, these all show that complexity and foundational principles, not just cutting-edge hype, define our digital world. The struggle to glue together an AI chatbot with proper guardrails is just as challenging as maintaining the legacy code that underpins our economy.
So the final provocation for you to consider is this. While we race toward artificial general intelligence in these massive gigawatt data centers, are we ensuring the stability and usability of the technology we already rely on every single day? The struggle to make AI deliver real ROI suggests we are still confusing technological capability with operational competence.
And if we are repeating the lessons learned from Y2K and early OS development by neglecting that foundation, what happens when we scale that fragile complexity to the next level of intelligence?
Something substantial to mull over until our next deep dive. Thank you for joining us.